0818-715-815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock today. And there's been a really strong reaction to that very distressing case that came from the courts yesterday, where four men were convicted of multiple sexual assaults of a 17-year-old girl in a car 5 years ago. Three of those men were convicted of rape, a fourth convicted of sexual assault. A fifth man, who had also been present, pleaded guilty of rape before that case went to trial. We know the judge yesterday said and paid tribute to the very, very brave young woman who was the victim of that case. And I want to go now to another very brave woman, Niamh Ní Gonal. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
Niamh, I know you don't want to go into the details of this, but I know that you will feel a huge solidarity with the victim in this case.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, it's always tricky when you read these cases, but certainly I actually remember kind of when I started reading a few details about it just over a month ago, and I do remember feeling ill kind of when reading about it. So, yeah, I think it's a hard time for anyone who's had these experiences or who knows someone who has, and I only hope that she's doing okay and that she has good support around her at the moment.
And going back, one of the issues in this case was like the length of time that girl had to, wait for that trial, for her case to come to trial. Like, you've actually been, you were not only through the criminal justice system, but you pursued a civil case as well. So you are really familiar with all the issues she will have been confronted with.
Absolutely. But I think in this case, the weight that she had was absolutely appalling. Like, it was a 5 or 6 year wait, and just and that's just within the kind of confines of the criminal justice system, where as a witness you are a witness, and realistically the state don't have a case, generally speaking, without someone coming forward. So she would have been required to not speak to anyone, not divulge anything to anyone, or to very, very select people, for fear of it prejudicing the case. And I can't imagine, I didn't have to go through that long of a wait for the criminal justice system, though it was long. I can't imagine having to hold all of that in. How do you heal? How do you kind of process? And I think Donnie made a really good point, but at the same time, you're trying to kind of remember the details and try and remember what you said in a statement. And the idea of kind of memories coming back in later, and did I say that in the interview. So 6 years or 5 years to wait with that is an enormous burden for her, I can only imagine anyway.
And to know, because of course we all have seen other court cases, we've all mm-hmm. seen the commentary around them, and know that defence barristers are going to question you really closely about your story and about, how you present those events. And as you say, to try and keep the whole event straight in your head, when actually what you really want to be doing is moving on from it.
Yeah, it's a really hard one, and it's hard for the criminal justice system not to be re-traumatising, because it's requiring you to remember exactly what you said in a moment or in a series of interviews with the guards. And that's an incredibly confronting thing to do. And oftentimes things, you remember something else later, or you wonder, did you say that the right way? So I think, I certainly recall waiting to go through the criminal justice system. And I think I was already cross-examining and interrogating myself, and how would I say something, or how would I come across? And I think that's the product of the society that we live in, that we live in a society that asks victims and survivors why they were in the situation, as opposed to really holding those responsible for who commit those kinds of actions.
How did you actually find the actual process of being cross-examined?
I should say mine was slightly different, in that Magnus pled guilty a month before we were due to go to trial. So I wasn't cross-examined in terms of evidence, but I was cross-examined on my victim impact statement, which I was told was highly unusual. So I have a very different experience in that I wasn't, the kind of veracity wasn't being called into question in terms of Magnus's actions.
What was called into question then? Was it the impact that it had on you?
The impact, exactly. Yeah. Which, you know, was deeply impactful for someone to actually ask you whether being raped and sexually assaulted really has an impact on you. Of course it does. And I remember making the point that we don't question when someone says they become a parent, we don't question that it's deeply impactful for them when they say that their world changes when this happens. Yet when you experience something deeply traumatic, I mean, rape and sexual assault are amongst some of the most traumatic things, most impactful things someone can experience. And of course, part of that is also the shame laden within that. So for someone to ask me, was it really that impactful? And I suppose all the while you're aware of the function of these questions, which is to undermine or to minimize or to reduce the impact on their client, as opposed to trying to kind of understand the impact that it had on you. I found it very hard not to feel almost part of a game in that kind of whole setting, which is, it's incredibly difficult, and it takes, I mean, in some ways it requires a lot of strength, but it's also highlighted to you that once the DPP take the case on, you can't back out. So although I suppose you enter in on some level with you've made a choice to enter into that system, actually at another point that choice becomes removed from you, and I think that's incredibly difficult.
Well, what do you mean by that? You mean that if you were to back out at that stage, you would be in the wrong?
Yes, that was it. Yeah, no, I really remember that being stated to me quite clearly. I think it must have been when Magnus had pled guilty that, you know, no, I couldn't kind of opt out of this anymore. This was going ahead. So I think you feel a lot of the weight of this whole kind of system, this whole process is relying on you, and you're there by virtue of something awful happening. You feel incredibly vulnerable.
You're the most fragile thing in the middle of this huge, enormous process that's happening, and yet it's all resting on you.
Yeah, and I think there's a kind of like a visibility factor in that you can't but be seen in it. You're at the centre of it all, and yet my experience anyway was that I felt incredibly invisible in all of it. I didn't feel like anyone was really seeing the impact that it had on me. In my own situation, I think I was perceived oftentimes as being a bit forceful because I would ask too many questions. So it's again, I can only speak to my own experience, but it's an incredibly strange process that obviously is likened so much to the reasons why you're there in the instance of kind of sexual violence or domestic abuse.
That you're saying it feels violent in itself.
Yeah, it is. And I think there's so little care taken. Again, I can only speak to my own experience, and I think things have changed certainly since I was through the criminal justice system. But I can't imagine, I mean, 5-6 years wait isn't showing care for an individual. It's not thinking about the impact that this is likely to have had on her in terms of how does she move on, how is she getting on in her day-to-day life.
Yeah, it seems just an intolerable scenario to place anybody in. You decided to waive your anonymity, Niamh. Why did you do that?
I suppose there was a few reasons. I remember prior to the suspended sentence thinking that it made, I suppose I'm loath to say it made sense, but I wondered about how common actually rape and sexual assault in someone's sleep was. It occurred to me that just because I hadn't seen or read much about it, that it possibly had happened to other people. So there was an element that initially of kind of maybe thinking, well, maybe this is something important to be spoken about. But I hadn't made my mind up in any particular way, but it was when the initial sentence passed to Magnus was that it was a 7-year sentence, fully suspended, so that he wasn't a custodial sentence where he went to prison. I suppose at that point, I just felt, what was the point of anonymity? Who was it serving? I felt that it was probably protecting Magnus more than it was protecting me. And I was trying to remind myself that I had nothing to be ashamed of, and that actually that shame he should have been holding. So it was realistically a probably very spur of the moment decision. No one around me was too happy that I did it at the time. But it was something that just kind of felt right, and it felt like the only thing I had in that moment to, the last thing that I had left was my identity.
And you saying people around you didn't support that decision at that time?
They were worried. Yeah, I mean, they were worried. It wasn't that they were very concerned that I had already been through so much. The impact had been huge on me in terms of, like, I had stepped out of a career I loved. I just couldn't do it anymore. You know, my family had seen me just completely change as a person. So they naturally worried about if there was publicity, or, you know, we had no way to know kind of what way the story or what way the case would be received. And they just worried that perhaps I would get more negative attention or something bad would happen to me. So that was why.
Yeah. It's 10 years on. How are you now, Niamh?
Yeah, it's 10 years since I left Magnus at the end of this month, which is, I've been thinking about that quite a bit. It's funny because I'm just at the end of a 3-year doctoral training program. So it's a very strange moment for these things to be kind of colliding or coinciding. I'm mostly really good. I'm very lucky to have great support and to have been able to make a really impactful, like a really fulfilling meaning out of something incredibly difficult that I've experienced. So I suppose the my own experiences of trauma really kind of, they're the center of all my kind of clinical work. And I feel very lucky that that's the kind of meaning that I've been able to make of it. But like anything, I think trauma is not, it's not a kind of a linear process. It's not something that, you know, it's 10 years ago, so you don't feel anything anymore. It can be very sneaky. It can kind of come up, and it's done that recently, where you have these blind spots and suddenly you realise it's really obvious that there are certain places that I, you know, still need to do a little bit of work or reflection on. But I think I'm in a really, you know, I'm very fortunate that I'm able to receive these kind of moments and kind of sit with them with kind of compassionate curiosity, as opposed to them kind of sending me tail spinning back into a place of deep trauma again. So I don't know if any of that makes sense, but it's something that you live with, and I feel fortunate that I'm living with it in a way that I've made a positive meaning out of.
That you've been able to make peace with it at some level.
On some level, but believe me, there are days where, it's hard not to be really angry that you're carrying something around that you never asked to.
Yeah, and I'm conscious when you say that there are days that this will come out of nowhere for everyone who has been through this. I just want to give people the helpline number. Let me just pull it up there. That's the 24-hour helpline for the Rape Crisis Centre. That's 1-800-77-8888. 1-800-77-8888. Because I do think that, you know, the reporting on this case that just came to a conclusion yesterday, and even just our conversations here now, Niamh, it will almost inevitably trigger memories and trigger emotions with people who maybe have never spoken about what's happened to them.
Absolutely. And I think the real power of a helpline, and just to say this for people, is that you can pick it up and you can dial the number and you can put the phone down and you can, you know, you always have power. And I know that it is so difficult to say the words out loud or to wonder, why am I feeling this? Because maybe sometimes for people, these things are touching nerves, they're activating something that they're unaware of why it is or what may or may not have happened. You don't have to know. If you're impacted, it's enough to know that you should chat with someone. And the beauty of a helpline is that it's completely anonymous. They'll never know who you are. But I think the important thing is to not sit in silence if that is making you uncomfortable or distressed, and that there is help there.
There is help there. That's a great message to get out there. Niamh, many, many thanks for coming and talking to us today. I know what you said will help a lot of people out there. I want to go now to Sinead. Sinead, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Sinead, you will understand what Niamh was saying there. You will have your feelings for this girl at the centre of this horrible case that we've been talking about today. But you haven't spoken about it before.
Recently and in patches over the years, I'm actually partly smiling, listening to Niamh, not obviously in a happy light, but it's ironic to me that she and I share so many similarities, but also polar opposites. Regarding the girl in the case yesterday, I struggle to even know what to say to her other than, don't be me.
Explain, Sinead. Tell us your story. It goes back a long time.
Oh, yes. I am 42 years old. I was raped. I still have to swallow when I say that. I was raped when I was 18 years old.
Take your time.
I apologise. Sorry, I didn't think this was going to happen so soon. I will compose myself. Apologies. I was on a night out with my friends in a nightclub in a town in rural Ireland. I had a silly argument. I can never remember what it was about. It's a long time ago, 24 years, with the guy that I was seeing at the time.
You were just a teenager at that stage,
Sinead. Oh, I was 18. It was the summer. So I was in Leaving Cert.
Right.
And it was supposed to be a summer of fun. So I remember actually we hadn't got our Leaving Cert results yet. So, you know, everything was still quite carefree, and that's the way it should be when you're 18. In any event, I had this silly little argument with the guy that I was seeing, and I haven't changed much in that respect. I got the hump and I stormed off home.
Yeah, on your own.
On my own. It would be about a 7 or 8 minute walk from that nightclub to the door of my family home. I was about, I don't know, I haven't been there in a long time, but I would say maybe 10 doors from home. There was a walkway with a slope, and I thought I heard something. The whole street was well lit, but in this one particular spot, the light wasn't working. And I remember walking along, talking nearly to myself, not out loud, but in my head about the argument that I just had.
And, because just to say, like, just to get people the picture of this, you didn't think you were taking any big risk here. This is a small town. You felt totally safe.
This was something me, my siblings, all of my friends, male and female, would have done all of the time. Everybody on that street knew each other. All of the families would have been friendly. It was extremely well lit. It was a good part of town. In fact, the whole town was a good town. You know, there was no major crime or anything like that. And even though it is 24 years ago, that's not that long ago. I'm only 42 now. It's not like I'm some old lady, you know. It's really not that long ago. I remember those Alco Pops were out at the time, and I'd had about 3 of them. I wasn't drunk. And I even feel compelled to say that today. And I feel like for the last 24 years, in my head, definitely, and towards the public, that I have to justify and make sure everybody knows that I wasn't drunk.
Because we can just say now, it wouldn't matter if you were drunk. That has absolutely nothing to do with what happened next.
And as Niamh says, there's things that you know in your head, but you're still worried about perception. Yeah. And that comes from, I guess, obviously inside, but it certainly comes from society. And it's wrong. I know it's wrong. I've always known it was wrong. I've always known I wasn't in the wrong. But it's like an angel and a devil on your shoulder, and they fight each other all of the time. And that was my barrier to never speaking about it. I was punched in the face when I heard a noise. I was completely shocked and disorientated. I'd never been hit in my life. And I was raped. I went home afterwards. I went to the nearest freezer. I took out a bag of peas. And I applied it to my face to make sure that there would be no mark in the morning. I got up earlier than normal. I had a summer job. And I made sure I was out of the house before my parents got up. I cannot explain why, but I instantly knew when it happened for me that I was not going to tell. That I would not go to the guards. I would not tell. And that wasn't because I knew the rapist. I still have no idea who it was, but I know that they knew me. It was a fear, but it was an overwhelming sense of shame. And I went to work and I pretended like nothing was wrong. And for the majority of the last 24 years, I have pretended that nothing was wrong. Over the years, I have had one too many drinks on a night out or whatever. I actually don't even really drink that much anymore. But over the years, when I was younger, I would have and become a little melancholy and told one or two people. But I would never say the word rape. I used to say things like I was attacked, just not able to deal with it.
Sinead, my God, that you've carried this for all these years without even being able to feel like you can tell people.
Mm. The saving grace was that, I mean, just to say the damage that it does. I think when cases happen like this, like that girl yesterday, or Aisling Murphy, or whoever it is, I would just like people to carry it for them for longer, what it is like to be that person. I think, like all news stories, of course, and all tragedies and events, if they don't happen to you, they go out of your head. But this literally wrecked my entire family. I have not spoken to my family in the guts of those 24 years. We'll call it 20 years. I tried for about 4 years because a little while after it happened, I told my then boyfriend, the guy I had the argument with, and he was young as well. He didn't know what to do. I just wanted someone to help me. I felt so helpless. He did all the right things. He advised me to go to the guards. He advised me to tell my parents. And I got mad with him because somewhere my head was so messed up, I just wanted him to save me.
What was your instinct? You said you knew immediately that you weren't going to tell people, that you weren't going to go to the guards. Where did that really strong instinct to you know, keep it to yourself come from, Sinead?
I think I came from a large family and they were quite a religious family. Although I was on the younger side of the large family, and by that time, a lot of the abuse in the church had already come out. My parents probably weren't as dedicated as they used to be, getting us to go to Mass on a Sunday, that kind of thing. But when you're raised in generations, as my parents were, and then me in the next generation, to be so religious, there was that kind of shame. And also my family was a very they were working class family, but pillar of the community. I didn't want to be the one to break that.
Yeah, and just
I also was a daddy's girl, and I just couldn't tell my dad.
And of course, a lot of women will relate to that, I think. You know,
yep.
That idea of this just being, you are the victim, but somehow you are the one feeling the shame.
And I do want to stress that as well. This was, even though this was a long time ago, I believe that these are feelings that other women have had, do have, and will have in the future. But you have got to talk. Like Niamh said, I live most of my life now, even now, absolutely fine. I have absolutely blessed in my life how my life turned out. And there's still that little odd comment you might hear someone say, because rape jokes are apparently hilariously funny, because nobody realises that the person sitting across from them has been raped. Or it could be a scene in a movie that I'm not expecting. Another night, I could sit and watch that same movie and it wouldn't affect me. But just sometimes it creeps up in you, it's very incestuous, and it just takes your breath away. But the one thing that will save any woman from further destruction is to talk. You've got to talk.
And you have someone to talk to now. You're no longer having to keep the full secret.
No. My mother, I told my mother a couple of months after it happened that I was attacked. I cannot explain in the moment or prove anything, but she knew and I knew that I meant I was raped. And she buried it. The following day, she told me that she was going to have to tell my father. I begged her not to tell my dad. The next day I entered a room that my dad was in and he told me to come in. He needed to talk to me. And I was shaking in my shoes and I was so embarrassed. I didn't want to talk about it. And I was afraid he'd make me go to the guards. And because I just did not want other people knowing, I was so ashamed. I just felt dirty. That's the one word over the years. I just felt dirty all of the time. And my dad said, come in here, I want to talk to you. Your mum told me what happened, you know, that real Irish thing. And I said, oh, I have to go and I'm going out with friends or whatever. And he said, no. Like, if anything else like that happens now, you make sure you tell me. And in that moment, I knew he didn't know the truth. I knew that she knew I had been raped, but she told him I was attacked. I tried to bury that with my mother. We never spoke about it again. And about 4 years later, I would have been 22, 23, and I just could not do it anymore. When I was 20, I met my now husband. And so we were seeing each other at this stage. He knew everything. I told him, not a couple of months after we were seeing each other, I told him. I can't explain it. Again, I wouldn't be one to think of love at first sight or whatever, but when I met him, I knew that he was my person. And he knew, and he has known all these years. And I constantly tell him that he saved my life. He will not take the accolade, but I would not be here without him as my sounding board. In any event, I told him one day, I am going to end my relationship with my family because I cannot look my mum in the eye anymore. I just can't do it. So that rape changed my life in so many ways that I never even could have foresaw.
And did you go, you know, seek professional help, Sinead?
No, I convinced myself solemnly that I could sort it myself. And looking back at it now, I am a teacher by trade, but I left being a teacher and I went into other caring jobs, and one of them was being a key worker in a women's refuge. And I know now, looking back on it, that that was my therapy. I did that to try and get back some control. That by helping other people and talking about their stories, and I had this hidden secret, I just knew I could help them because of what I had been through. That got me through a lot of years, feeling that I had done good, that I changed something for someone else.
And as you say, you have your husband who knows your full story, but am I taking from you that very few people actually do know this story, even now?
Well, myself and my husband, as I said, are together 22 years next week, and his parents and his siblings I have known for 17 or 18 years, and I have only told them last year because I still felt ashamed. 2 years prior to that, just before the pandemic, I started having nightmares again, and this sense of guilt. What about the potential other women that were raped in that town because I didn't stand up, I didn't do something, I didn't call the guards, I wasn't strong enough? So I wrote to the guards, and from that town, because I wasn't living there anymore, I don't really ever go back there. I just can't. It's too painful. And they came to my house, and they were unbelievable to me. Skilled, trained, professional, compassionate. And it was two men. And they were amazing to me and my husband. We talked through everything. And ultimately, they told me it was never too late, that they could investigate it. And I will be a hypocrite, even though I didn't go that route. I would certainly advocate to anyone who wants to do that. Our police get a lot of negative in this country, but regarding rape, they were absolutely amazing to me. I'm not taking away from Niamh's experience of court cases and the law. I just mean I'm talking about two individual Gardaí that were extremely nice to me.
Yeah.
But I chose not to do it because my parents are still alive and my dad is quite sick, and I just didn't want to upset them. I switched off my love for my mother. She feels like my biological mother, but not my mother. But I still am not a malicious person. I wouldn't go out of my way to hurt them or embarrass them in their later years. Why would I do that? So I chose not to follow it up. But I just needed to know inside, had there been many other cases at that time? I just had to know. And thankfully, the answer was no. And I know they were being truthful with me.
And that gave you a sense of
great solace.
Yeah, that gave you a sense of relief that you know, by not reporting, you hadn't let anybody else exposed.
Absolutely.
And it's incredible credit to you, Sinead, that even in that, you know, through all that trauma, that your thoughts were for other women, strangers even, that you know, that's some says something about you, I think.
Thank you for the compliment. I don't feel that way a lot of days, but I will take that compliment. Thank you.
Sinead, as I say, you obviously, you've held this secret for a long time from most people, but you've told us now. You're on the airwaves. You're telling this story.
It feels incredible. I didn't know when I woke up this morning that I was doing this today, but it feels like a relief. And the reason I did it today is obviously to try and help other people, but I selfishly did it for myself. I don't do a lot of things to myself, and I've learned this year that I owe it to myself. Before Aisling Murphy died, about 2 months before, I was on a walk by a river myself, and a man was, oh my God, the man was so far away from me. And I never had a panic attack in my life, but ultimately I had a panic attack. Just made notions in my head that something bad was going to happen with this man and totally freaked myself out. I came home, I was just shattered. And I knew then that I could not control this beast anymore and I needed help, professional help. I talked it through with my husband, and that very day I contacted the Rape Crisis Centre, and they are the reason that I'm able to talk about this today. Even after the first session, just to say the words out loud and give me little things to work on and build my confidence and just listen and be an ear. And sometimes, like when you write something down in black and white, it's hard to believe what you're reading. Yeah. But I had been so silent so long and so ashamed. To hear myself say the words and talk about it over and over has just done something great to me. I don't know what it is, but it has done good things.
Sinead, and I'll give out that Rape Crisis Centre number again, 1-800-77-8888. And will you stay, because I've got Mia on the line, and she wants to pay tribute to you for what you've just done now. Sinead,
oh my God.
Have a listen. Mia, good afternoon.
Hiya, good afternoon.
You wanted to say something to Sinead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you for being on air now and telling us your story. I'm so heartbroken for you. I'm so heartbroken for all the rape victims that aren't able to speak about what happened to them.
Mia, you have your own story?
Yeah, I was raped when I was 16 in a park. And I was drinking as well, and that was a huge problem because I wasn't able to tell my parents for similar reasons, what Sinead was saying. It was that generational. It was around the same amount of years ago as well, about 20 years ago or so. And immediately, no, nobody's going to know about this. I didn't even know that what happened to me was rape, fully. I'd been drinking, and the main thing was, like, I can't get in trouble. And I did something wrong, and I did something sexual, and that's really, like, you don't want to talk to your parents about, or, like, your dad about having done something like that. Not that, you know, I did it. It's been done to me, should I say. And it's so heartbreaking because it just tries to wreck your life. It tries its best to wreck your life, and you have it with you for the rest of your life.
What age were you, Mia, when this happened to you?
I was 16 when it happened to me. And it led to all sorts of problems because I wasn't able to talk about it. Because there was nobody safe in my life that I knew wouldn't freak out or wouldn't judge me or wouldn't... It'd be a big blow-up, big drama, do you know? So I never got any justice. And every time there's a rape case in the media, like the one you guys were referring to earlier, like I cling to these things. I cling to sentencing and a conviction for a little sense of justice for myself. But like, okay, well, these rapists are taken care of, at least.
And this was, as you say, a long time ago as well. In Sinead's case, over 20 years ago. Have you been able to get some help over those years?
Yeah, it was 22 years ago for me. Well, it led to a load of problems. I ended up being sexually exploited, and the rape made me incredibly vulnerable and made me kind of end up choosing behaviours and choosing situations, unconsciously choosing them in a kind of a self-harming kind of way. I ended up being sexually exploited for a few years and eventually got out of that situation. And then and then it's been like good 11 years of trying to put all the pieces back together for myself. So that's what happens when you get raped or any trauma like this, like sexual trauma. You get fragmented and splintered into lots of different parts. And the healing is like trying to integrate all these parts back together again.
Yeah, put the jigsaw back together.
Yeah, so you can kind of live a happy life. And it's really hard.
Is it important, do you think, to speak about it for you? You know,
Yeah, it's really important that people talk about it. And that we normalise talking about it, because I think things are getting much better. But it's still highly stigmatised talking about these kind of sexual assaults, and most women do not, and most girls and most boys don't report these kinds. because of the reasons me and Sinead have and so many others have. So we need others, the people who have not been raped, need to normalise talking about this and need to understand how trauma works and how these things work and the impacts of these things. So we, as other people, can be safe people for those who get raped or assaulted or abused or whatever happens to them. You know, that we're informed.
Indeed.
So that we can help, that the survivor isn't there on their own having to go and find a counsellor or whatever and just be on their own with it, that it's a community thing, it's a family thing.
Mia, thank you so much for calling. Sinead, thank you so much for telling your story. You are you're a very brave woman.
Thank you to Mia and Niamh and Katie. Thanks to everyone there, especially Shan. I just can't say enough about how it needs to be talked about, and thank you to Liveline and RTÉ for highlighting it yet again. Hopefully someday you won't have to.
Indeed, indeed. We'll take a break. Thank you all. Thank you.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And I'm joined now by another amazing woman, Dominic Meehan, who was raped in 2015. Dominic, hearing about the rape of other women must bring you right back to your own case.
Very much so. It brings up back a lot of anger, a lot of anxiety, and a lot of worry for anyone that is in this situation. If they're waiting on a sentencing or even just the trial, it takes so long for even just word to come through that of a date that the trial is going to be on. I was waiting nearly 2 years for a date for the trial. It is an awful time waiting.
And just to remind people, if you can, Dominic, if it's okay to do that, just a few of the outline details of what happened to you.
On the 4th of July 2015, I was attending a convention where a man called Keith Hearn from Tala locked me in a room in one of the convention rooms and raped me until someone barged into the room. I gave my statement on July 6th, and by the end of August I was in a psych unit for everything that was happening.
Yeah. And you, I know you've said this before, you didn't make a decision, a cold decision, if I can put it that way, to go to the guards to you know, put this into the official train. It happened. Events overtook you because, as you say, he was discovered in the middle of what was happening.
Yeah, the man who broke into the room basically shouted at me, call the guards, call the ambulance, call everyone. And I didn't have the wherewithal to be like, I don't want to report this. So it obviously I'm very glad I did it now, but it was in the heat of the moment. I knew this man was dangerous and I needed to be safe. So I needed to call the guards, and that's unfortunately what I did.
Unfortunately what you did ultimately.
Unfortunately had to do. Yeah. Needed to make myself safe from someone who was extremely dangerous.
Subsequently, it was discovered that man had a rape kit with him. There was a plan there.
Yeah, Keith Hearn had told me during the attack that he had a knife and he was going to use it if I didn't shut up. The knife was, as I've always said, the knife was never produced. But I made that split decision to just do what he told me to do because I needed to get out of that situation alive.
Okay, so now we want to talk about the system and what happens to you when you cry rape or you say, I've been raped. Mm-hmm. Did you go to a sexual assault unit right away?
Yes, there wasn't one available in Dublin at the time. I was raped in Blanchardstown. So I was driven to Mullingar by ambulance to go to the SATA unit, which is the sexual assault treatment unit. They're their own problem in itself. They're absolute angels, but there are not enough of them. I've been campaigning for years to get more of them around the country, but it added to the trauma having to be driven from Blanchardstown to Mullingar, where I was treated.
And you gave a statement right away, did you?
On July 6th, so it would have been, I was raped on the Saturday, I gave it on the Monday.
That must have been very difficult.
I don't remember it, to be honest. I remember sitting in the room, and then I remember going for a smoke with the investigating Garda, and then I was brought back into the room, and then my parents were there. I don't remember giving the statement.
Then, of course, the wait starts, the system takes over, and it's out of your control then, what happens and court dates and all of that.
It seemed to go very quickly at first, that my Garda liaison was there every week or so, but then it just kind of ground to a halt for a year, and nothing happened at all. And I was just waiting for that date to come through.
And were you able to, was your life continuing as normal? Like, how were you at that stage?
I was trying to go to college. I was trying to do games development. Unfortunately, my PTSD caught up with me and I had to drop out. I repeated the year and I had to drop out again. I've never been fully functioning since.
You mentioned a Garda liaison officer there. Do they stay in touch with you right through this process?
They stay in touch as far as developments, but if there's no developments, you don't hear from them. So it's my Garda liaison was fantastic, but there's only so much that they can do if there's literally no movement in the case. So I didn't even know that he had anything other than a knife with him. Until the trial itself, I found out that he had condoms, he had rope. Like, there was, there was so much in that was never told to me.
Yeah.
That it all came out during the trial, or during the sentencing, because there was no trial. He eventually pled guilty.
And in terms of that statement, you say you don't actually have any memory of giving your original statement. Was that your only engagement with your statement?
No. That's what was honestly the worst part of waiting, was that every so often my Garda liaison would come back and she'd ask me to reread my statement. And because of shock, because of trauma, I'd remembered things out of order. I'd remembered things later on that weren't in the statement originally. So I'd have to amend my statement. I think I amended my statement 3 or 4 times. And every time my Garda liaison repeated to me that this wouldn't matter. But in the eyes of someone who had been raped and had heard about people not being believed, I was so sure that the amount of times that I amended my statement, the DPP would just decide not to try and would not believe me. And that it is a reality for some people. I was very lucky. I know I was. But
and of course, yeah, Dominique, for you, like, you had a witness. The act was stopped in mid, you know. So even for you to still feel like, would you be believed? Would you be doubted?
Yeah, I was so sure that I was going to be doubted by either the judge, by the jury, even by friends and family, that I had to tell them that I amended my statement again. Or the few people that know, or that knew at the time, if I had told them the amount of times that I amended my statement, I was so sure that they were going to be like, I hear now. There's only so much to remember. No, not really. It is terrifying. I can't even get the words out. Like, it is. It's the insecurity of it. It's awful.
And I'm thinking about the. You know, and I don't want to go into any details because obviously sentencing still has to happen with this this case that we had saw the convictions in yesterday. But that was 5 years coming to court. Your case was in court for
nearly 2 years.
2 years, and torture that 2 years was for you.
Absolutely torture. I couldn't tell anyone in case it somehow got into the media or got back to
Keith Hearn and his barrister, I was so scared that if I told someone that it would affect my case in ways that couldn't be foreseen. So the only people who knew were my family and one friend. And then you also that I was raped in public. So I had all these people who had some idea of what happened, but they didn't know what and they didn't know to who. So all these stories were going around because the convention community is quite small. So these stories were going around that someone was attacked. I think I even heard that someone was murdered. So I couldn't be like, no one was murdered. It's just gossip that people that was flying around that I couldn't tell them exactly what had happened. And it's very isolating.
Yeah, and as I said, 2 years, it's a very long time, even the 2 years you had. And there was a subsequent an appeal on the sentence because your attacker got 12 years and he appealed it, but that appeal failed.
9 to 12.
Yeah.
I remember I was told on the Tuesday that he was appealing and by the Friday I was back in the psych unit. I couldn't have taken that isolation again. I couldn't have done it. Thankfully, I was told while in the unit that this wasn't the same, that I didn't need to keep it back.
Dominique, how are you now?
I'm getting on. Like I was saying to my father just last night that my housemate had started kickboxing. And she had asked me if I wanted to come. And I was like, no, it's too violent. So I haven't even learned how to defend myself since it all happened. I haven't completed college. Thankfully, I'm working full-time, but I'm working full-time at home. I don't go outside. I don't have many friends. The friends I do have are fantastic. The family I have around me are fantastic. But it's like a death in the family. Like, that grief will always be with you. You just learn to be okay with it.
You mean you're grieving the person you were?
Exactly. Like, even now, nearly seven years on, I can't sleep on my right side. I immediately have to turn over onto my left because during the attack, I was on my right side for a very long time. I can't sleep on my right side anymore.
I know, and I know you need to go, Dominique, but I know you wanted to express solidarity with the victim in that case that everyone was reading about today.
Yeah, and everyone who's going through this, like it is hard, it is difficult, but please just make sure that you're safe, that you've gone to the STATU unit, the sexual assault treatment unit. Make sure you're going to counselling. Just grab all of those facilities that are out there for you. They are free. Don't leave yourself feeling alone like I was.
Dominique, you are an amazing person. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for you're so brave. Honestly, I'm in awe of you. Thank you so much for giving us your time and sharing that with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And I want to go now to Annie. Annie, you called to pay tribute to Sinead, and we still have Sinead on a line there. So Annie, what do you want to say to Sinead?
I would love to say, Sinead, I'm sitting in my car in a hailstorm. I think you're an amazing woman. You're a heroine. You're a true heroine. You're going to bring this to life. I think it's amazing what you've said, and you had the strength to get through all of that. Just, I think you're going to help an awful lot of people going forward. I'm a mother. I have something, I had things myself, things happened to all of us in those days. We never spoke about it. Maybe partly to do with the Catholic Church and everything else, the way we were brought up, and not to shame the family. But I think for young people going forward, you have done an amazing job to speak, to tell your story today. I just want to say thank you. And I want to say thank you and to the other people who participated, whose names I don't have.
Yeah, but to Mia and to Niamh and to Dominique.
All of you, all of them. I mean, it's so important to say this because we would never speak out. You'd never say anything. And then it just carries on in through life and in through the next generations. It's just, I just wanted to say thank you. And I think Sinead is a heroine, and everybody else who's able to tell their story. I want to say thank you to them. It's very important.
It really is.
And they're amazing.
Do you think, Annie, that there are a lot of Sineads out there, people that are carrying this?
I think there are an awful lot. Because we couldn't speak out.
As you say, people of your generation, of Sinead's generation.
Yeah.
Sinead?
Yes, hi.
Yeah, and that's Annie, and there is more people. We're getting a lot of messages. Another one here, such brave women we're listening to. They should be so proud of themselves. Another one, sending love, compassion and thanks to Sinead for sharing her story. I'm so angry and heartbroken for her 18-year-old self.
Oh, God. Annie, thank you so much, and to all my fellow women warriors, we're still standing. Dominique's story, Annie's story, I think it's time for change. My story is 24 years old, and I am conflicted in 2022, listening to those women and the court case yesterday. I didn't go to the cards 24 years ago in 2022. It's so hard. I don't know if I would have been made for that system. And the other side of me, of course, says and support Dominique when she says, get your rape kit, report it, do it. It's hard, but do it. I think it's time for change. If in a pandemic we can rush laws through the Shannas, etc., for whatever we need to protect society, why can we not protect our women of any age or children? There's children raped in this country, male and female, every day of the week. You bet your bottom dollar. Why is the system so hard, and why does it take so long to change anything to protect the vulnerable in our country? With Dominique's story, she has just highlighted it's not just about the rape, it's the aftermath. Not one of us have said that we got any financial help for anything. If you want to go further to get more help, in Dominique's case, it was her mental health. I don't think anyone probably paid for that. I don't know, but I doubt it. And in my case, I took a yellow, it wasn't yellow, it was orange. I took an orange rope in an apartment in that town. I had to move out for the last year before I ended my relationship with my mother. And I put that orange rope around a metal beam of a porch. And I almost went through with ending it all, except for my now husband text me on my very old brick Nokia phone. And that one text, like I said earlier, that man saved my life in more ways than I can ever say. And there are some amazing men in this country. But for the ones that are bruised, damaged and evil, there has to be change. And the least the government can do is get these laws pushed through to make it easier for women like Niamh and Dominique. They deserve more.
Yeah, and again, I'll give that helpline number, 1-800-778-888. That's the helpline for the Rape Crisis Centre. I'll take a break.
Joe Duffy! Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we're getting a huge reaction to, as you can imagine, to all of those calls that we've had today. Really some extraordinary women. Just a flavour of what's coming through. Thank you for telling the country what happened to you. You've helped many women listening today. I resent the attitudes women have to worry about when considering reporting sexual assaults as well as the crime. Women suffer the fallout of dealing with the criminal process and effects on family relationships and concerns over people seeing them differently if they come forward, all the disruption in their life plans. I hope these attitudes and fears will be a thing of the past. Again, another caller saying, my story is almost identical to Sinead. And I know we're getting a number of those calls in. Other people saying, Sinead's story is my story. Women who are still not able to come on the air, but they want people to know that Sinead is not alone. One last one there. Sinead's story makes my heart sink. The shame that women feel when they're violated and destroyed. It's not just the physical sexual assaults that derail their lives. Women are left with their self, their identity in tatters. Still the burden on themselves. Societal attitudes, which we create, have very much to answer for. And I want to bring in now Nolene Blackwell. Nolene, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Nolene, I don't know if you heard, were able to hear much of our programme today, but...
I heard and I was just in my own head, just standing. I didn't hear Niamh, I just couldn't get that, but I heard Sinead, I heard her story. I've heard and I've had been a huge admirer of Dominique, and I heard Mia as well. And I just thought what wonderful people they all were, and how their witness, how their testimony to you and to the nation today said more, I think, than, you know, I work in a rape crisis centre. We work to support victims. There are 16 rape crisis centres around the country. We support and empower survivors along the way. But my goodness, those three women that I heard, and I understand Niamh's every bit good. They were just amazing.
And Mia as well. Yeah, we had Mia and Annie
yeah.
who also acknowledged that there were stories in her past as well. But Nolene, where are we with this now in terms of supports for women who decide, and the very small number of women that we know that do actually report these crimes and you know, pursue prosecutions or allow prosecutions to be? Where are we? Like, we see 5 years for that case that we're talking about today to come to court.
That was a desperate one. So in some ways, Katie, and again, I heard this from particularly from Sinead just there a little while ago, and Dominique as well. The first thing for people is to remember that it really, there are supports out there for people themselves to just disclose it. Because one of the things that I think came across very strongly in all your interviews there was the depth of the harm that is done by rape and other sexual abuse. And I don't know that we talk enough about that impact, which is invisible, but which is so serious for people along the way. So there's the first thing is the disclosure for themselves to get the help that they need. And that's where, I suppose, just you've mentioned it already. I heard you mention the helpline, but the 24-hour national helpline is there, as well as all the offices of the 16 rape crisis centres and others dealing with sexual violence as well, like 1 in 4. So those supports are there, first of all. But then some people will take the decision that they want to report it as well. And that everyone has to make their own decision. But at the moment, it remains a difficult decision to make. Loads of us will remember the commitment of the then Minister for Justice, Charlie Flanagan, back in 2018 after the Belfast celebrity rape trial, where all the defendants were acquitted, but everyone agreed that the justice system was cruel to victims. And a process started which is taking too long, but there is some recognition that our trials take too long, that we don't even do simple things like make decisions in advance about some of the rules, how the trial is going to go. New legislation has just been signed into law by the Minister for Justice in February, saying that if you want to do things like introduce certain types of evidence into the case, do it in advance before the trial date so that a trial can go ahead. But there is still an awful lot to be done in this area. We are getting more specialist investigators, and I think it was maybe Sinead or Mia who spoke about, or Annie, who spoke about the great guards who came. There are more good investigators, trained investigators coming in, who actually, the value of having trained investigators is they take better evidence and they take it more quickly. So that is an improvement, but there aren't enough there. And then COVID has really ripped through the court system for all sorts of cases, as people will know. But in those cases of rape where you need a jury, or serious sexual assault where you need a jury, we haven't been having juries in court. So there's a 2-year delay. In a case where there was not enough judges already to hear these cases. So we need more judges, we need more courts, we need better trained lawyers and everyone in the justice system to understand the impact of the trauma. Because again, I think it was Dominique talking about the fact that she had to change her statement because the shock and the damage done by the assault on her actually meant that she had misremembered things, or her brain had accepted things in the wrong order. So we need to understand, everyone needs to understand the impact of trauma on the brain and the damage that the court case can do. Because I can't tell you how regularly we hear from people that the court case, and some people say it publicly, people like Sarah Grace have said publicly, that the court case is every bit as bad as the initial assault, which in itself was a terrible thing to happen. So change is starting, but not fast enough.
Yeah, because we know that the current Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, has made a huge, a major commitment to making a serious change in her time and during her tenure. But just simple things like, I know, and this is one Sarah Grace had raised after her case, the idea that she had to advocate for a screen to be placed between the man who raped her and herself in a courtroom. Because we know courtrooms are small places and you could end up almost within touching distance of a man who had violated you in the most horrific way. That's still the case, isn't it?
And that's still the case, and that's still not sorted out. There are moves to fix all of these things along the way, but it's still not sorted out. And in Sarah's case, for what it was worth, there was the small advantage that it was a stranger. In cases where you know the person who carried out the attack, it is so much worse. It could be someone in your family or someone who was a friend of yours, So in those cases, again, that sitting right beside them. Some people do want to actually, in fairness, sit and they want to face down their accuser as well, but that there isn't that it's not possible to give video evidence. That, for instance, in relation to young children, for instance, that if a child of 10 or 11 is sexually assaulted, that we still don't have ways in place to take all of their evidence there and then so that they don't have to repeat most of their evidence 2 years down the line. Yeah. So even if the trial was a couple of years down the line, if people could feel that they had been able to give their evidence quickly so that they could start to work to put this assault in its proper place in their minds, that it doesn't overtake their lives. Right. But we don't have those systems yet. And there are ways of doing it much better than we're doing it. But in truth, until this administration came in, until the last few years, there was no attention given to the fact that sexual offence trials are particularly difficult because you are talking about cases where the evidence of the victim is the key evidence to decide was the activity consensual or not. And so much depends on them being able to tell a story, which, I often say, you wouldn't even tell your closest friends some details like that, but you have to tell it to a room full of strangers. So we still don't have a system fit for purpose, but there is something positive, not for people who are going into court today or tomorrow, but there are positive moves in the justice system to recognise that the current system is entirely unfit for its purpose and needs adjustment and fast.
Okay, Nolene, we'll leave it there. Many, many thanks for that. We'll leave
it on
a bit of a positive note after, I think, some fairly tough listening today. We'll take our last break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And that's all we have time for. Thanks again to all our amazing callers today. Today's programme was produced by Sean O'Gorman. Lee Mullen was on sound. Elaine Conlon was the broadcast coordinator. Stand by now for Ray Darcy.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.